From California to New York, West Virginia to Arizona, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, emergency Obamacare subsidies enacted during COVID are about to expire, and they are the reason for the partial shutdown of the federal government. Paul Teller of Teller Strategies is here to explain. It is known as Operation Arctic Frost and may be the biggest Biden administration scandal. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. A Rhode Island property owner is in a court battle to protect his private property rights. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with J. David Bremer of the Pacific Legal Foundation. And former Congressman Keith Rothfuss makes his debut as an American Radio Journal commentator with a look at how the Founding Fathers would approach a new development in the field of artificial intelligence. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. U.S. Senate Democrats refused to reopen the federal government in a standoff over temporary COVID Obamacare subsidies. For details, we turn to Paul Teller. He is president of Teller Strategies. Paul, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Paul, the partial federal government shutdown that has been going on now for about a month, a lot of it centers around subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as most people know it. Tell us a bit about what these subsidies are and what they were intended to do.
Yeah, exactly. These were enacted when Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were in the White House, and of course, Democrats controlled Congress, and this was during COVID. This was during a time when they said, because of the COVID emergency, we're going to have a temporary program where we're going to add additional layers of subsidies onto Obamacare. In other words, as many folks know, Obamacare is already providing heavily taxpayer-subsidized, basically government-run health care. This was an additional layer of subsidies on top of that, on the notion that, hey, it's COVID, it's an emergency. People are having even more trouble paying even their existing premiums, which weren't even that bad at the time, but let's make them even lower. Well, guess what? The only way they were able to enact them at the time was to put an expiration date on them, which made sense, right? I mean, presumably when the COVID emergency goes away, so should these additional subsidies. Well, that expiration date is the end of this calendar year, December 31st, 2025. That's why Democrats are right now making a push for this as part of the shutdown, saying, hey, even though COVID's over, we still should continue them. We should keep them going. And obviously, many conservatives are saying, no way.
If these subsidies that were put into place, Paul, here as part of the effort to fight the impact of COVID, if they go away, there's still, as you mentioned, there's still considerable subsidies. So this isn't This isn't taking Obamacare and health care away from people, correct?
Exactly. Nobody is losing health care from this. Nobody's even losing most of their subsidies. There's a group called EPIC, you may be familiar with them, the Economic Policy Innovation Center. They've put out just fantastic information showing that if you take away these COVID-era Obamacare extra subsidies, that some of the plans are still subsidized by the taxpayer at a tune of 90%, 85%, things like that. So in other words, many, many taxpayers, especially ones at the lower scale, income scale, are going to have the vast, vast, vast majority of their premiums paid for by the taxpayers even after these expanded ones expire. And here's the thing, too, and we know this like in anything in life, sometimes there's a little bit of an emergency situation, so you do things a little differently during that emergency. We can all agree COVID was that emergency. And so while we would have been against the role, because we're against adding additional subsidies at the time, they did get added, they're in current law, but that emergency has gone away. So you don't keep the emergency subsidies when the actual underlying cause of the emergency has gone away. And that's kind of what most Republicans are out there saying.
Obamacare, of course, as I mentioned, is known as the Affordable Care Act. The fact that you have these subsidies, has it really fulfilled that affordable care promise that was made?
Well, that's right. I mean, and that's why we're kind of chuckling when we say the name, because not at all. Because even with so much taxpayer subsidies, government-run healthcare, the reports that the average person's premium, I think, is still going up like some double-digit percentage next year, meaning 10, 15, 18, 20% premium increases just because of all the federal mandates that are a part of Obamacare, other factors leading to rising healthcare costs, inflation, things like that. Point being, premiums are going up anyway. So what Democrats want to do is they want to leverage this and say, premiums aren't going up because of the inherent faults of Obamacare. They're going up because of the Republicans, those naughty Republicans. And of course, it's terrible, and that's not true at all. They're going up anyway. They just, for some income brackets, like some higher income brackets, will go up slightly more because we're looking to take away or let expire the emergency COVID era additional subsidies. And by the way, we should point out these additional subsidies, they don't even go to individuals and families. It's not like these are checks that were going to people and suddenly they're not getting checks. They went straight to insurance companies who, by the way, are also allowed to keep those extra subsidies even if there's not a claim filed against them. That's what's amazing. And I know that's getting maybe a little too complicated for our purposes today, but the simple way of thinking of it is an insurance company can get a subsidy for person XYZ, but if person XYZ doesn't go to the doctor, the insurance company still keeps that additional subsidy from the taxpayer, doesn't have to refund it. So that just doesn't seem fair, and it should expire.
We then, of course, have this shutdown, partial shutdown of the federal government, Paul, because the Democrats in the U.S. Senate refuse to vote for a clean CR. They want to address this ending of the special subsidies, the emergency subsidies, before doing that. What is really the purpose of it? Republicans have said, okay, you know, we're willing to have a conversation on this and where it might go, but let's keep the government open while we have the conversation.
Yeah.
What political gain is there for Democrats to shut the government down at this point, perhaps deny people SNAP benefits going into November,
right,
when the conversation can happen anyhow?
It's a great point, and that's something to point out to your listeners, is that the Republican House already passed the CR, continuing resolution. That's fancy Washington jargon for keep the government open as it is, current levels, which, by the way, most conservatives, most Republicans don't even like current levels, right? We're trying to cut government, but we're offering a compromise saying, why don't we just keep everything as is and then keep negotiating from there? So the House passed that. The Senate keeps trying to pass that, the Republican-controlled Senate. Democrats keep blocking it in the Senate. They keep filibustering, which requires then you need 60 votes. There aren't 60 Republicans in the Senate. So Democrats keep blocking, just keeping things as they are, current levels. And we've now had many leading Democrats say the quiet part out loud. They've literally this week admitted they're doing this for leverage. They know it's a leverage point. So they're using the American people and, frankly, the American government as leverage to extend a government healthcare program, an extended, expanded portion of a government healthcare program that was intended to expire once COVID went away. So it's just for political gain, and they admitted it publicly this week, which is really a shame.
We will see how all of this ends going forward here, hopefully soon, in a matter of days rather than weeks, but who knows. We have been talking with Paul Teller. Paul is president of Teller Strategies. What do you do at Teller Strategies, Paul?
A new consulting gig I just opened up this month was privileged to work for directly for Advancing American Freedom as full-time staffer for these last 4 years since the White House. Just thought it was time to, if you will, go out on my own, do some political consulting, legislative strategy, policy strategy, coalitions. In fact, one of my first things I did was put together about a 3-dozen group coalition aimed at telling congressional leadership, hey, stand strong on these Obamacare subsidies.
Paul Teller, thank you for being back with us. We'll look forward to talking to you more in the future. Take care.
Appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. It is the time of year here, Scott, where we get our first frost, but there's an Arctic frost that you want to talk about. Fill us in on the details, please.
Thanks for having me back, Loman, and it's great to sort of inform the listeners about this big story that's not receiving a ton of coverage in the legacy media, but I think that it could be sort of the biggest political scandal. And that's saying a lot to come out of the Biden administration. What we are learning now from the Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley, a longtime senator, he now has subpoena power and oversight power with the FBI to sort of get some answers on how conservatives and the inner Trump circle were targeted to try to prevent President Trump from ever reassuming the Oval Office in the 2024 election. This was a big investigation that basically targeted conservative voices and leaders that were very skeptical of the 2020 election results. it's a fair position and protected underneath the First Amendment to express your speech and to say, hey, I think there were irregularities. I think that the election was rigged. Some people thought the election was stolen. We all saw that there were more people that showed up in the 2020 election than ever before, and those numbers actually reverted back to the norm in the 2024 election. But what happened here was there were over 40 field officers with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, led by Christopher Wray and Lisa Monaco at the Department of Justice, and the Attorney General Merrick Garland, and they were basically surveilling not just U.S. citizens and people that were in public office. They were surveilling at least 8 United States senators, members of the House of Representatives. We're learning that they actually wiretapped Senator Ted Cruz's office through a whistleblower. You had a targeting of major organizations from the Conservative Partnership Institute, where Mark Meadows works, to the Heritage Foundation. Obviously, anybody that was basically affiliated in a direct correlation with President Trump was being surveilled. And it really was this true political witch hunt. And we are going to learn a lot more in the coming months, I think, about the extent that Joe Biden was involved, what his senior staff was doing, and really the steps that they took to try to prevent President Trump from ever getting back into power. The good news is we won in 2024. President Trump is putting big points on the board, and Kash Patel and the FBI are now turning over these documents that are mostly unredacted to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And this week, I think they released about 1,700 pages of information related to the Arctic Frost investigation.
We will, of course, continue to keep an eye on this as that scandal unfolds here. Always interesting to see, Scott, where these things go. In the meantime, a little more urgent, we have an election on Tuesday. The Commonwealth of Virginia, the state of New Jersey, will be electing governors. How do things stand in each of those states as we enter the home stretch here?
Well, you might remember all the way back in 2009 when Chris Christie won in New Jersey. That was a boomerang election following the election of Barack Obama. And then in 2021, following the election of Joe Biden, Glenn Youngkin won in Virginia. So a lot of people are kind of like, well, this is probably going to be that boomerang election where the Democrats win in these off-year elections in New Jersey and Virginia. But I say, not so fast. We need every single voter to show up, because the bottom line is, in a state like Virginia, in our Commonwealth, Donald Trump received about 2 million votes, and he lost Virginia by about 5.8%. But when Glenn Youngkin won in 2021, he received roughly 1.6 million votes. So there's a lot of people that vote for Republicans in presidential elections that just don't feel the motivation to come out and vote in a big statewide election, and a governor's race, and an attorney general race, and lieutenant governor's race. But the reason it's so important to get out and vote for Republicans is if we sit this one out, the whole Trump agenda is going to get stifled. They're going to try to do redistricting in Virginia and basically evaporate 3 more congressional districts to try to resume the balance of power for the socialist left and AOC and all these radicals in the House that are just going to try to take steps to impeach President Trump if they regain power in January 2027. In New Jersey, you got Mikey Sherrill against Jack Chiarelli. Again, New Jersey is sort of one of those states that a lot of people say, oh, is this even in play? How can we win there? Well, we've won there before. We've had close races there before. And Chiarelli has a good economic vision to try to improve the environment of job creators and investors in a state that neighbors New York, which is about to elect a communist in Mamdani. And so November 4th, it's a big, big election. We can't sit this out. We've got to make sure to show up and vote.
We, of course, next week will take a look at all the results from these races with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us once again a little bit about the Club for Growth.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. We're united in the idea of economic freedom and liberty and opportunity. If you want to learn more about us and the candidates that we support, visit clubforgrowth.org, where you can actually join to sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. as always. Thank you, Scott. Appreciate your being here.
You're welcome.
A fight over property rights is heating up in the state of Rhode Island. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with J. David Bremer from the Pacific Legal Institute.
After a storm damaged part of David Welch's beachfront property in Rhode Island, he found out that just getting the permits necessary to repair his property would require giving the public and government officials basically unfettered access to it. So much for private property. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, J. David Bremer. And he is representing David Welch in a ongoing legal battle in the state of Rhode Island over this bizarre question, this bizarre issue where the government has said that you basically can't rebuild your house without all sorts of other conditions tacked onto it. We're glad to have him here to explain all this to us today. David, thanks for taking some time and joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll get into some of the legal stuff here in just a second. Let's start with the facts. There was a big storm in 2023, and David Welch's property got dinged up a little bit.
Yes, but actually you have to go back a little bit earlier to really understand what's going on in this case, what this coastal agency in Rhode Island is doing. In 2023, Rhode Island passed a statute, a new law, that expanded the public beach area inland from the mean high tide line to a point farther inland onto private property across the entire state. And so they redefined private property as a public beach, and that included David Welch's property, who he owns as an LLC as Stilts. So Welch and Stilts challenged that initial 2023 law as a taking. They said, you're taking private property, you can't change the public beach from this location in front of my house to back behind the house. That's just taking my property. And a court ruled that, yes, that's a taking. The state then appealed to the Rhode Island Supreme Court, and that's been sitting there pending, just waiting for a long time, a year and a half, a year, something like that. So that's the backstory. In the meantime, the storm comes along. So it did some damage. It wasn't irreparable or anything like that. It moved sand around, scoured away the stairs, and knocked down some fences, stuff like that. And so he applied for a permit to repair that stuff. And long story short, they agreed to give him a permit, but subject to two objectionable access conditions, which I suspect you'll want to get into.
Yeah, let's talk a bit more about that. I mean, basically what happened here is there's already an ongoing lawsuit to decide whether the state can just redefine what was private property as public property. And then before that even gets settled, the local government, I guess this is, or is it the state government, is saying, well, wait a minute, we haven't even settled that issue yet, but we're gonna say you can't repair your home unless you basically admit that this is all public property.
Right. So the agency at issue is the Coastal Resources Management Agency. It's a state agency charged with jurisdiction over the coastline in Rhode Island. You can think of like a mini California Coastal Commission. And what they did is while this case is still at the Rhode Island Supreme Court about whether it's a taking to expand the public beach onto Stilts property, and the trial court had held that it was, the agency said, well, you know what, you need a permit, and we're just going to stick this taking into your permit now. As a condition, we're not going to wait for the Rhode Island Supreme Court to decide whether this is a taking or not. We're just going to do it now, and you can have your permit, take it or leave it. And we're also going to ask you to submit to inspections of your property at any and all times before, after, during construction of your repairs.
We are chatting with J. David Bremer. He is a senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, chatting about this case in Rhode Island. Let me tell you, David, what drives me crazy about this is that you've got this guy, David Welch, is already fighting one lawsuit to protect his private property. Now he's got to fight another one. I know you guys at PLF are there to help him do that, and that's wonderful and fantastic, but a lot of people in this situation wouldn't be able to fight multiple lawsuits just to protect what was already their private property. And you can see, you know, this is where property rights really matter, is on the local level like this, right? It's not a national issue, it's not a federal issue necessarily, but it is an issue that matters very much when the local government or the state government comes for your land. I know you guys have had some success already in this case, thankfully. Tell us a little bit about what's happened so far and where you think it could go.
First of all, you're right. There's no one without us, without Pacific Legal Foundation, a lot of these cases are impossible, and that's why people should support Pacific Legal Foundation. But in this particular case, as far as the result, we secured a preliminary injunction stopping the Coastal Resources Management Council from imposing these public access and at all times inspection conditions on Stilt's property. But it went further than that as well. The court said the agency has to stop in general imposing public access conditions on permits, not just Stilt's, but coastal permits in general, unless it makes an individualized determination in each permit that requiring public access is directly and roughly proportional to the actual impacts of each project. What I mean by that is it's already lawful for an agency. If you build your home and you somehow intrude upon existing public access, they can require you to mitigate, okay? So what the court's saying is to the agency, you got to do that. You got to show that there is an actual need caused by this repair project or this development that causes the need for some public access mitigation, which in Stilt's case, there is no need for it because it's a repair project from private property.
We are unfortunately out of time for today. You can read more about this case at pacificlegal.org. David, thanks for taking some time with us here.
Thank you.
And once again, that's J. David Bremer. He is a senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. Again, read more about that case at pacificlegal.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out everything we're working on this week at reason.com and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Today, we welcome former Congressman Keith Rothfuss as our newest American Radio Journal commentator. He applies the principles of our founding fathers to the expanding reach of artificial intelligence on this American Radio Journal commentary.
As America approaches the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, we're seeing renewed interest in our founding principles and what the founders might think of the nation's challenges today. Their insights remain surprisingly relevant, and I suggest we might consider how their perspectives on freedom and virtue might influence some of the debates around artificial intelligence. I've suggested before that two pillars undergirded the American Revolution: sovereignty in the people and God-given, inalienable rights that even democratic governments cannot revoke. The Declaration of Independence explicitly references the Creator from whom these rights flow, and the natural laws tied to that Creator. Because the founders envisioned limited government, they understood citizens needed to be virtuous. John Adams recognized that maximum freedom under our system required a moral and religious citizenry. George Washington counseled that of all dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. Yet the founders were realistic about human nature. James Madison wrote in Federalist No. 51 that if men were angels, no government would be necessary. The founders understood humanity in terms of right and wrong, good and evil. They recognized our capacity for both virtue and vice. Next year's 250th anniversary offers a timely opportunity to observe how our founding principles might guide the adoption of new technologies, particularly artificial intelligence. Daily reports chronicle AI's growing influence on the economy, education, the military, and our personal lives. Debates are picking up over whether and how to regulate this field, with many influential voices arguing for minimal or no restrictions, citing competition with China or the need to let a promising industry flourish. In this context, I criticized the House-passed version of the One Big Beautiful Bill's inclusion of a moratorium on state-based AI regulation. The Senate removed this provision in the final bill. Given AI's novelty and the sky-high valuations of companies in the field, criticism of the industry, however, has been muted. But a recent development demands renewed attention, at least from those who can influence the marketplace with their purchasing decisions. OpenAI, one of the industry's biggest players, announced just weeks ago that ChatGPT, its flagship product with hundreds of millions of users, would now venture into so-called erotica, a term closely related to pornography. This marks a troubling departure from OpenAI's idealistic launch 10 years ago, when the company proclaimed its goal was to advance digital intelligence in the way that is most likely to benefit humanity as a whole, unconstrained by a need to generate financial returns. CEO Sam Altman's reversal is particularly striking, given his statements just weeks ago in an August podcast with Cleo Abram. Altman claimed OpenAI was avoiding sexually related products that could, quote, juice growth, and that he was proud of his company's ability to resist such temptations. But apparently that approach wasn't helping OpenAI's bottom line. As writer Matt O'Brien noted, letting ChatGPT become a friend or romantic partner could be another way for the world's most valuable startup, which is losing more money than it makes, to turn a profit that could justify its $500 billion valuation. In a recent interview on Tucker Carlson's podcast, Altman explained that developing OpenAI's guidelines included getting feedback from the world. He argued OpenAI's guidelines should, quote, reflect the collective moral view, close quote, of its user base and represent a, quote, weighted average of humanity's moral view, which will evolve over time, close quote. Missing from Altman's analysis is what the founders understood. Humanity is fallen, and society benefits when institutions promote the virtues needed to mitigate against such a state. But when actors in the growing and powerful AI industry opt for a relativistic collective view of morality while moving into a subject such as pornography and then train chatbots on that fallen humanity's work product, the result is predictable. Fallen humanity at scale. It is troubling to see the world's largest chatbot take the plunge into porn-related content. And this move will not be a positive for a nation that needs a virtuous population to sustain self-governance and liberty. Yes, OpenAI is promising age gating, but is increasing availability of this diminished view of sexuality good for anybody? Internet pornography is a multi-billion dollar industry that exploits countless individuals and fuels unhealthy addiction, affecting family formation and stability. It contributes to the undermining of the sacredness of human sexuality as it was designed by the Creator and is part of a larger fallout that has left men and women alienated, scarred, and brokenhearted. Unleashing AI's exponential power into this sphere will dramatically worsen these problems. Now is not the time for the culture to surrender more ground. Rather, it is time to promote the virtues that build better communities. To that end, I took one small step last week in canceling my $20 a month ChatGPT subscription. I believe humanity is better than what ChatGPT is now offering. The founder's wisdom endures. Technology may be new, but the moral questions are transcendent. As we celebrate 250 years of American independence, their insight into human nature and the need for virtue remains our best guide forward. For American Radio Journal, I'm Keith Rothfuss.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WZFCAM in Winchester, Virginia, WEEM-FM in Pendleton, Indiana, along with KMWV-FM in Salem, Oregon. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.